Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
Sydney, we have a sort of unusual situation this week.
We have a guest in the studio today.
A guest in the studio.
A silent guest. Well, we'll see. That remains to be seen.
Yes. As designed, she is a silent guest who is watching weird vids on the iPhone. Normally she would be in school when we record Sawbones, but she is not. So Charlie Gail McElroy is here with us today.
She may have something to say at some point.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's up to her.
It's up to her. But it'll probably be, I don't like this weird vid. Give me a new, help me find cookies. We'll see.
Yeah.
But now that has established, you'll understand why we say this is also a special episode of Sawbones, because we're doing something a little more flexible. How's that?
Well, we love to do episodes where you send us your weird medical questions, your wacky medical inquiries.
You're zany.
And we answer them. These are not, again, as always, this is not advice. This is just stuff that you want to know about that I may be able to help you find answers for. And, you know, I learned something too this time around.
Yeah.
I learned something upsetting. That's like the first question.
You've already given me a sneak preview of this, so I'm gonna. But we actually have a late first question, and this is the most important one. It comes from Justin. It says, "Sydney, why does Charlie get my nice chair in the studio, and I get this terrible task chair that we all hate and we would throw away if any of us felt like lugging it upstairs?" That's the first question it says here.
Because she's being very patient.
She has all her life to look forward to.
She's being very good right now.
She has no reason but to be patient.
So that mommy and daddy can record their podcast.
I'm in my twilight years. All I have is this chair, and you've taken it from me and given it to her. Yeah. She has youth. She has beauty. She has everything.
And she has your chair.
She has my brains and my chair. Yeah, I guess so. This first question is from Lacey. It says, "My fiance always yells at me after I go to the bathroom to close the lid of the toilet. She's also kicking me. Close the lid of the toilet before flushing. She believes that if you flush the toilet while the lid is open, germs from your recently expelled waste will splash out of the toilet bowl and on and near my surfaces, making our bathrooms unclean and will in turn make us sick. Am I correct in thinking this isn't how gravity or germs work? And how do I explain to her that leaving the lid open while flushing is perfectly fine?"
So, Lacey, I did a little digging to check this one out, and I was very disturbed at the results.
Mm-hmm.
So, it turns out that in 1975, someone published a study on the effect of what they called toilet plume aerosols.
Oh, boy, that's rough. That's already rough.
Yeah. Now, this is not true for if you have like one of those low flow, you know, toilets. If you have a low flow toilet, then it is not this extensive. But back in 1975, not very many people did. And so a regular powerful flush from your standard toilet can shoot a plume of aerosolized droplets into the air 15 feet high.
That sucks. I mean, it sucks. It sucks. Like, we don't have enough to worry about, honestly, really.
Now, in 1975, when they published the study, they made the point that your toilet bowl is almost certainly already colonized by lots of different germs, bacteria and viruses, depending on what you've come in contact with and what's in your waste products and if you are sick. And so they pose this theoretical risk. Could you make yourself sick if you flushed with the toilet seat open? Now, in 2013, they did a review of this literature, and they found that while this is still true, that the toilet bowl definitely has these germs in it, and you definitely do shoot them into the air when you flush with the toilet seat open, there has so far never been a documented case of someone actually becoming ill from this. Mm-hmm. So it is still just a theoretical risk. There is no proof. Mm-hmm.
But
at the end, there was the consideration, maybe just shut your toilet when you flush. And maybe if you store things near your toilet, like toothbrushes, like up on the counter, like ours, our toilet is right next to our sink where there are like cups with toothbrushes. Like maybe you might want to put those somewhere else in case you forget occasionally to shut the lid or if somebody else does.
Yeah. Now this shouldn't be a problem if it's number one, right?
No, I mean, it's a problem for anything because, like I said, the toilet bowl is colonized with whatever has been in there before. Okay. So.
Now, here's how I discovered this fun fact, beloved listener. I went into the bathroom last night to brush my daughter's teeth. We do Chompers. It's a Gimlet Media thing. It's a podcast, but it's also an Alexa skill. If you haven't tried it, do try it because it's fantastic. Just ask Alexa to open Chompers. And it's a 2-minute morning and night show about brushing your teeth. And it educates your kids. It's fun. And you get to hear a bunch of
It's actually
fun
about
facts and
all
songs.
Kinds of
it's
things.
It's about all
it's,
the kinds
it's
of things.
For brushing your teeth, but it teaches you about all kinds of things.
But every like 30 seconds, they tell you like, okay, now brush the right upper side of your teeth. Anyway, it's great. And it keeps a track of your streak. We like traveled around with our Alexa for a few months to get to 100, which is the highest you can go. But we did it anyway. It's inspirational. So I went to do Chompers last night, and the toothbrushes were gone. And I was like, Sydney, where's Charlie's toothbrush? And she said, oh, I read something today that horrified me. And this is a new thing. We're going to start putting them in the drawer. So I looked, and yeah, Charlie's was in the drawer. And Charlie's travel toothbrush was in the drawer. And Sydney's toothbrush was in the drawer. But there's one that wasn't in the drawer.
Justin has this weird electric toothbrush that actually charges itself in the cup that it sits in. So I knew if I took it out of the cup, it would no longer be charging. So I was going to have a conversation with him about what he wanted to do about toilet plumes. And I had not had it yet because I didn't want to tell him until we recorded because he doesn't get to know these things until we record.
If you were talking about the
I had to maintain the integrity of the show above all else.
You were talking about the harrowing proximity of our toothbrush eye to the toilet. And which one would you say is perched precariously, gargoyle-like, above
the
toilet?
Yours is the
Mine
closest
is the closest. J'accuse.
It has to be near the outlet because you have that weird cup. Anyway, here's the point, Lacey. No one's ever gotten sick from this. So it's fair for you to say that it's probably not going to happen.
Except,
but at the same time, I'd just go ahead and shut the toilet. I would go ahead and give this battle up. I would concede this one.
It's probably a good habit to be in. How's that?
Yeah.
It's probably a good
You're
habit
probably safe, but it's such a... Go ahead, shut the toilet. Such a small risk. Go ahead and shut the toilet. That's what. Well, at least that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. I have one from Shell. It says, so recently I've discovered I've got some pretty annoying keratosis pilaris all over my arms and legs. The discovery of them being there isn't new. I've had them most of my life. It's just recently I learned there's a name besides chicken skin or crocodile skin, like the old folks in my family have always called them. Anyhow, I was just wondering how common these little bumps are. Google tells me it's pretty common, but I don't feel like I've really seen them on anyone else. Sydney, I don't know what this is.
This is really common. I that's why I thought it was worth answering this question, is because a lot of our listeners may have this and just didn't know there was a name for it. Keratosis pilaris, which is very commonly called chicken skin. It's like little bumps that you might have. They could be red or white. They're little teeny bumps, and they're most commonly up on like your outer upper arms, like up under your shoulders, like mm-hmm. like in that area, and your thighs. If you feel, as I'm saying this, you might want to reach up your arm and feel, you may have a few. All it is, it's a genetic disorder. It's totally benign. There's nothing scary or dangerous. It shouldn't cause you any discomfort or itching or anything like that. But it's basically where you produce too much keratin and it blocks off the hair follicle and you get a little bump there. Oh. And that's it. It's totally benign. Again, it is present in between 50 and 80% of adolescents. Some people do grow out of it because by adulthood, we find it in about 40% of the population. So it's still incredibly common. Mm-hmm. So it really is. There probably are lots of people who might not know a name for it because they may just have never noticed. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people have this.
This is a common thing, huh?
Totally common, totally benign. If it super bothers you, and I mean, and this would be from like a cosmetic standpoint, if you just don't like the way it looks or feels, sometimes you can, like, there are creams, there are medications you can get from your doctor, topical things that you apply on the outside, pretty easy to treat, but it probably will come back. That's one thing to know. If it's genetic, it'll probably come back. You can help if you keep your skin from getting too dry. But if it doesn't bother you to just be there, you don't have to do anything about it. It's totally benign.
I don't want to worry you, but I was feeling for these bumps you're talking about. I actually feel these really big bumps underneath my skin on my arms. Like, they're underneath my, like, the top of my arm. There's just this huge bump.
Oh, okay.
Right here.
Justin is now flexing his muscle and rubbing his muscles. Huge, he's now rubbing his biceps.
It's like one huge bump.
Okay.
Right here.
Move on to question
is this
three.
Normal?
We've got a bunch of questions.
It
move
doesn't
on to question
seem
number three.
Possible.
Move on to question number three. It's especially relevant to you.
From Damien, says, so despite your husband's better judgment, I got the Nightmare King from Burger King. Aw, Damien, no. I did, however, encourage people to do precisely that and tell me about their dreams. Mm-hmm. Can the deliciousness that is this burger really cause nightmares?
So, Justin, you referenced on your other podcast.
One of my other dozens
of
podcasts.
Other podcasts. You referenced this burger and the fact that there was a study that supposedly supported the claim that it can increase actual nightmares if you eat it.
Yeah. Hold on a second.
No, wrong show.
It's on this podcast,
no,
too.
No, we don't do that here. We don't do that.
I want a munch!
Nope.
Sid?
Nope.
Sid?
Nope.
Sid?
Nope.
This is the first crossover podcast.
Justin, can I, if I say it, can I move on?
Yeah, I want a munch!
Squad.
Welcome to the Munch Squad. It's a podcast within a podcast, and this time it's in a new show. It's called Sawbones, and if you haven't heard me cover this, I just want to tell what the burger is really quick.
Okay, really quick.
I ate one, and I was shocked that you didn't give me more trouble about it. It is a burger patty with bacon and cheese and burger fixins and mayonnaise and a chicken breast.
Yes.
That's the nightmare part of it, and that's what they're saying is, get bound to give me nightmares.
And it's also green.
It's also, the bun is green. Yeah. It looks like a, Charlie said, yeah. You know what it looks like in person? You remember You Can't Do That on Television? Remember the guy Barf, the chef, on You Can't Do That on Television, the stuff he made? Yes, that's what it looks like.
So
it looks like a garbage pail kid version of a hamburger.
So they really did do a study of sorts. Burger King did a study with Paramount Trials and Florida Sleep and Neurodiagnostics Services. And basically, 100 people ate the burger for 10 nights before they went to bed. And then they were observed while they slept. And they said, did they give you nightmares? And what they said is that the average, on average, like 4% of the population has nightmares on any given night. And in this study, it increased by 3.5 times. Now, the problem, the number one problem is there was no control group.
That's the number one problem. With this entire situation,
so
the number one problem is that they didn't have a control group.
They talk to you about nightmares ahead of time, and they ask you questions about nightmares, and they ask you if you had any nightmares. There's a lot of bias. You needed to do that and then have people eat something that wasn't the nightmare burger.
Believe me, friends, you would know if you had eaten the nightmare burger. There would be no control group that you could establish for this sandwich.
There has never been a proven link between what you eat and nightmares. So I thought I would address that. They've never found that, like, eating certain foods are more likely to give you nightmares or not. Like, they've done some studies to find, like, people who are really thirsty, like, who hadn't had enough water, like, sometimes dream of water. But, like, past that, like, there's really no influence as to, like, what you eat. Like, that whole bit Scrooge does about a bit of undigested beef or a blob of mustard.
Old potato.
Yeah, none of that is. There's never been anything like that. So it. No, it can't give you nightmares.
Amanda says, if I have more than one, maybe two, that is more than one, alcoholic drinks in a night, no matter what kind of alcohol, I pretty much always wake up around 2 or 3 in the morning, 100% of the time. Then I have a hard time getting back to sleep. Surely some of that is due to anxiety, but I think it's the alcohol that wakes me up in the first place. Why? I suspect sugar has something to do with it. I kind of know this one a little bit.
Go for it.
Alcohol helps you fall asleep, mm-hmm. but is bad for your sleep overall. Mm-hmm. I know that
yes,
to be true.
That is very true. That's exactly right. Alcohol does reduce sleep latency, which is the time between when your head hits the pillow and when you fall asleep. So you fall asleep faster, which you, I mean, most people who have ever had a drink before bed could probably attest to that. But it messes up what we call your sleep architecture. And that's kind of the how you go in and out of deeper stages of sleep as mm-hmm. you know, throughout the night. That's supposed to go in a regulated fashion. And alcohol takes you into deeper stages of sleep faster. And you skip the REM sleep that you need. And then as you metabolize the alcohol and it's coming out of your system, you actually rebound into those lighter stages of sleep and probably have like micro awakenings that you don't even know you're having. So your sleep is poor. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not getting good sleep you need. And then actual awakenings that you are noticing. So it's the alcohol coming out of your system that is actually waking you up, which is why you wake up early, you know, in the middle of the night or early in the morning. It also contributes to like, it messes with your pituitary hormones. Mm-hmm. So things like melatonin are a problem, prolactin. Also neurotransmitters, chemicals in your brain that send signals, things like GABA and adenosine, all these things are affected by alcohol. So overall, alcohol is bad for sleep. You really shouldn't drink right before you go to bed to get good sleep. I saw somebody make a point that like the best time to drink throughout the day is happy hour.
Oh yeah.
That happy hour, because you'll metabolize the alcohol before you go to bed. So perfect. It won't mess up your sleep. I don't know if I have a study to support that that's true, but I will say if you drink right before you go to bed, it will mess up your sleep. And this is a problem because up to 20% of adults in the US use alcohol to help them sleep at times.
Huh.
So
it's a
not
short term fix, but not a long term.
No, overall, you're going to have disrupted sleep and fatigue if you use alcohol to help you sleep. So don't do it.
Dave says, during a Bim Bim episode, Justin asked you a medical question, but we never got an answer. When a person with a penis gains weight, does their penis also gain weight? Why or why not?
I thought I could continue never answering this question forever.
Nope.
But here it is. No.
Someone at a live show at our book signing mm-hmm. actually asked you this.
Yes.
Follow up.
Yes.
Young fan.
Yes. So the people need to know, and no, the penis just doesn't. It just doesn't gain weight. It's just not an area where a lot of adipose tissue is going to accumulate. That's where you gain weight. Places where you're going to store a lot of fat tissue, adipose tissue, and you don't tend to do that in penis tissue. So the penis will not get bigger with weight gain. If anything, actually, just on a side note, if you gain more weight, your penis may actually start to look a little shorter because like a good amount of the penis is actually like the base is actually kind of inside the body.
Uh-huh.
And the less adipose tissue there is in that area, the more of that you can see. So the penis can look lengthier.
Okay.
So weight gain might, it doesn't actually change the size of the penis in any way, mm-hmm. but it actually might appear somewhat shorter if you gain weight. And if you lose weight, it might appear somewhat longer, but and it's not actually changing.
Mo says, I grew up in Australia and a common home remedy for an ulcer in the mouth is to put Vegemite on it. I always assumed because it was rather salty, so it's an alternative to washing your mouth with salt water. Are there any home remedies you grew up with and still use regardless of your medical knowledge?
I had to really think about this one because since I know how many don't work, even the things that I used to use when I was a kid or like that mom still tells me to do sometimes, I won't because I stubbornly and like I know they don't work, so I won't do it. I do employ the honey for a cough for kids over the age of one who have a cough because there's really no good medicine. Uh-huh. Like, I mean, honestly, a lot of the over-the-counter cough and cold medicine you just shouldn't use for kids.
Yeah.
Outside of like Tylenol.
Don't go to the pharmacy and buy the homeopathic cold kids remedy. It's just honey. It's honey that's charging you four times.
And you can give your kid a spoonful of honey as long as they're over one. And that would be fine. The evidence for it isn't amazing, but there is some. So I use it because even if it's not helping a lot, it's harmless and it's honey. So I gave her a spoonful of honey. She likes that. So I do that, even though the there is evidence, but it's just not crazy robust. And then we do have a jar of Vicks VapoRub, even though that really doesn't do anything.
You use Afrin.
Is that a home remedy?
I mean, it's not a home remedy, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, studies say it doesn't work. So these are, I don't really use a lot of home remedies. The only thing I've ever really been guilty of is ginger, and there's evidence for ginger. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not, but you're not going to find this, even the stuff that does work, that's like herbal or like a home remedy kind of thing, like what we'd call folk medicine, even the stuff that probably does work to some degree, you're never going to find a lot of robust evidence for it. But no. My skepticism has driven me away from it.
Sid's ruined a lot of them for me. I used to try like elderberry for cold and emergency.
Use Zicam and vitamin C. Yeah.
Nothing works.
No.
No medicine works. Sid's ruined all of it for me.
That's not true.
Philip says, why do I always have to poop after I exercise? Why do I always have to poop after I exercise? Philip didn't include the question twice, but I stumbled the first time, and I feel like I'd just read it. Say it one more time, because it's fun to say.
We kind of talked about this before when we talked about runner's trots, runner's diarrhea, which has to do with just a lack of blood flow to your intestines.
Runner's trots is just good old-fashioned American diarrhea.
It has to do with when you are exercising and using your muscles, you're diverting blood flow there to, like, you know, use them. Because that's where your blood needs, you need oxygen when you're using your muscles. And so they divert it away, it diverts it away from your intestines. And that can cause diarrhea later, and dehydration can. There's also, just with exercise in general, I didn't know if I'd ever mentioned this before, the mechanical, like the jostling of your intestines adds to that.
It shakes everything up, knocks them loose.
It's one of the things we tell somebody like who's been in the hospital for a while and is, and as a result, can't poop, is constipated. They need plenty of fluids. Obviously, if they haven't been eating, we got to get a diet back on board. But the other thing is to get up and walk if you can. Get up and walk the hallways. Movement can stimulate your bowels, so it makes sense that all that jostling around can as well.
Well, folks, we got a bunch more great questions, but we are running long, so I am going to take control here and shuffle us quickly to the billing department.
Let's go.
The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth.
Caroline, or Carolyn, what to say? Caroline? Let's go with Caroline. I'm a 19-year-old girl in college. Over the summer, I started the pill. Since then, I've been noticing some fluctuations in my sex drive. It seems like before I started taking the pill, I was just ready to go all the time, 24/7. And now I'll go weeks where I'm just not feeling it at all. And then I'll be super horny out of the blue. Is it my birth control or am I just aging?
I think this is a great question, because the truth about birth control is that it was the need for reproductive freedom is so strong and so present even today that a lot of the real deal side effects and drawbacks to birth control as it was originally conceived were kind of overlooked, because people who had uteruses were so desperate for some way to control that, to, you know, to take control of that part of their sex life and that part of their future. And there are real side effects for sure. And they're different for everybody, which is why there are a lot of different kinds of birth control. And you should, if you're not sure about the kind you're using, if you're having problems, you should always talk to your doctor. There may be a better option. All that being said, it's really unclear exactly how birth control tends to affect libido for most people. Some have shown an increase in libido. Others have shown a decrease in libido. Probably for most people on birth control, there isn't a significant change in libido one way or the other, but it definitely can have an effect for some patients. Mm. It can depend on the kind of birth control and just how it's interacting with you. I would say it's not aging, because you're still, in the grand scheme of things, quite young. I do not mean that in a derogatory way. You're on the young side. I would not expect your libido to be affected yet, based on your age. So it could be, I guess, is the answer. It's unlikely that birth control will decrease libido, but it is certainly possible. I would go talk to your doctor and see if there maybe is something else that wouldn't affect you that way, because it's possible.
Here's a question from Elspeth. It says, I've heard some people say it's okay if you don't have periods, and some people say it's unhealthy if you don't have them, e.g. on birth control, etc., because it's supposed to, quote, clean out everything. Sydney, what's your take on this?
It is no problem if you don't have a period, as long as you know, by the way, that you are not pregnant. That would be the only thing I would say, is that if you're not having a period and you could be pregnant and you haven't taken a pregnancy test, I would do that, because it's important to know. Mm-hmm. but barring that specific scenario, if you are taking birth control and so you're not having periods, or if you just are very irregular and you don't have periods very frequently, that's okay. That's, I mean, if it's not bothering you, there's nothing inherently dangerous or bad for your system. As someone who has, myself, I have PCOS and I have incredibly irregular periods. I will go months and months. It's fine for me. It's just, it's nice not to have them personally. Although it is a major hassle because you never know when they're coming. So that's kind of annoying. But if it's not bothering you and you know that you're not pregnant, I always want to reiterate that because you should find that out if you think that's a possibility. Barring that, it's really okay for your body not to have a period.
Here's a question from Austin. Do women actually have more hormones than men? Or is that a somewhat sexist saying, like being hysterical?
I'm assuming this is in reference to the idea that like the comment, oh, she's just being hormonal. I think that's probably what we're referencing here. Mm-hmm. That would be a sexist thing
right.
to say.
Right.
Yeah, I would say that it's still a sexist thing to say because we all have lots of hormones, all of us, and all of us have them in varying amounts. The hormones we typically think of as the quote unquote female hormone, like estrogen, or male hormone, quote unquote male hormone, like testosterone. Those things are certainly present in different amounts. And a lot of that has to do with what kind of secondary sexual characteristics we develop. So does a person develop breasts, or do they have a penis or a vagina and all that? Obviously, those things are all under the influence of hormones, but we all have lots of hormones floating around in there that do all kinds of things. And you don't have more based on your gender or based on the genitalia that you have. You just have different ones. So, yeah, that would be my general advice to everybody, is don't ever call anyone hormonal in reference to anything.
Yeah, it's just like a wild thing to say about anybody in any context, honestly.
Yeah, I just wouldn't. And they fluctuate throughout our lives at different ages, too. So we have different amounts at different ages. It's just, yeah, hormones do a lot of stuff, and they have nothing to do with if you just don't like the way somebody's acting. Yeah. I wouldn't. Yeah.
Jared says, I've read there are more bacteria cells than human cells in our bodies. Is this true? If so, how much of our mass/weight is actually bacteria?
This is a myth that I had to bust on myself. Really? I used to think this. I used to say this because I had heard this too, that we are more bacteria than human. It's actually probably closer to 1-to-1 than the average human.
In a mass, weight, or number?
Number of cells. Number of cells, number of bacteria is probably around the same. I think the number was like if you take like an average size human, which is like a 70 kilo human, I think it's like your standard size, you would have like 39 trillion cells and like 30 trillion bacteria.
Okay, but like if you were to take all that bacteria out of us and just like put it in a bucket, would it be like half our body weight? And if so, and what would it look like?
It would look like a bunch of bacteria. I don't know. It would look gross.
It'd be so gross.
But I mean, they're microscopic. So like,
all cells are microscopic, individually speaking, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I guess if you have enough of them, I don't know.
It's wild.
It's wild to think about.
It's wild to think
about.
But
the point is, and it varies. Some people might have 1-to-1 bacteria to human. Some people might be 2-to-1 in one direction or the other. But the old,
I think
they
used
the
people
to say,
that are 2-to-1 bacteria to human. I think that's pretty obvious at this point.
We used to think we were 10-to-1 bacteria to human, and that is, we know that's not true. That most of us are pretty close to a dead heat between bacteria and human cells.
Here's a question from Frank: is it true that if you eat too many carrots, your skin starts to turn orange? Are there other foods this is true for?
Yes, you can. You have to eat a lot, but yes, your skin can start to get like a yellowish, orangish
sheen.
Yes, if you eat a lot of anything with beta carotene in it is what it is. That's what's in carrots. It's most noticeable on the palms and soles. You can distinguish it, by the way, from jaundice. You know, jaundice when your liver isn't working correctly, mm-hmm. because then like the whites of your eyes will turn yellow, and that won't happen if it's due to carrots. Yeah, there are other things that can do this. Eating too many tomatoes can make your skin kind of yellowish orange as well, and it's because of lycopene mm-hmm. in the tomatoes that can accumulate. any of these things that change your skin color like this, from just eating too much of it, you can change back if you don't like it by eating less. You just avoid carrots for a while, avoid tomatoes for a while, whatever it is, and your skin will gradually, I mean, it takes a while, but over the course of months, it will go back to the way it looked previously.
You should do a detox, a special, special detox that I'm selling right now.
It's most commonly seen in kids, which I guess is just because as we get older, we realize, like, man, there's stuff that tastes better than carrots.
Or when you're a kid, you're like, if your parents can figure out one vegetable that you like, it's just like, oh, thank God.
That's probably what it is.
I can sleep at night and feel like a decent parent. Here, eat 30 carrots.
I bet you that's what it is, because like our kids always loved like carrots and sweet potatoes and squash and pumpkin. I'm surprised they didn't turn orange.
Yeah. Anna comes in with our last question. Okay, when my nipples are stimulated, I feel weirdly sad, specifically homesick. I looked it up, and apparently this happens to a lot of people. What the heck is that all about?
I sympathize with this because I have experienced it before. It is so dysphoria, that kind of sad feeling that can happen with nipple stimulation is really well known because it tends to happen a lot to people who breastfeed. They call it DMER, dysphoric milk ejection reflex. And it is that feeling of like sadness, longing, want, need. Homesickness is a good way to describe it. There are a lot of different terms people use to describe it, but it happens a lot while people are breastfeeding, as the milk lets down.
So weird. Bodies yes. are weird, Sid.
It's a weird feeling. I have experienced it myself. I used to describe it as thirst.
You would get thirsty?
It made me feel like I needed like to go have a cold drink of water. I would feel like acutely dehydrated or something. I don't know. It's a weird feeling if you've ever experienced it, but it is common. We don't really have a great name for it happening outside of breastfeeding so far, because that was kind of where it was first described. But now we've realized that it can happen with any kind of nipple stimulation to some people, not to everybody, but to some people. The mechanism is not completely understood. We think it has something to do with prolactin and dopamine, and like those things, prolactin specifically can be released either for breastfeeding or also just with any kind of like sexual stimulation or orgasm. It can. So that's why nipple stimulation of any kind can do this. It has something to do with maybe a drop in dopamine, we think, but it's still poorly understood. But it is a known entity. It's not just you. A lot of people experience it, and I really don't have a great way to tell you to combat it. It yeah. just happens.
Bodies are so weird. Okay, this is actually the last one. It's from Nick. I have two little boys, 2 and 3 years old. Sometimes they fill their mouths too full of food, and it just kind of sits there for a bit and gets chewed up a little bit before they spit it out. I try to tell myself to get a little nutrition out of this. Am I just fooling myself?
You're not completely fooling yourself. It's just probably not the nutrition that you want. The main thing that you can absorb through, because your mouth is lined with a mucous membrane, so you can absorb things through your mouth. That's why some medications, like we absorb under our tongue, you know?
Oh, right.
So like you can absorb things through your mouth for sure. There's stuff in your saliva, enzymes that can break things down. But most of what you can absorb through your mouth quickly is sugar. So like carbohydrates and sugars could be absorbed through your mouth in that way, possibly. But like proteins and fats and a lot of vitamins and things. Most of the stuff you're wanting the kids to get is, it really needs to make it to the small intestine to get it. So a little, but you're not completely wrong, but a little.
Folks, that is going to do it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening to our program. Thanks to the taxpayers for the use of our song medicines as the intro and outro of our program. We have a book. It's called Sawbones the Book. You can find it on Amazon or at fine bookstores.
It's actually called The Sawbones Book.
The Sawbones Book. That's what I said.
You said Sawbones the Book.
Sawbones the Book. It's The Sawbones Book. Correct. Yeah. Thank you, Sid. if you want a signed copy, you might be able to call the Books a Million in Charleston at the Dudley Farms Plaza or the Huntington Mall. The Books a Million's there. We just signed a bunch of them and left them in stock. So if you call them, and they might ship you a signed one. I don't know if that'll work or not, but it's worth trying. Real quick, we wanted to tell you there. If we could just ask for your help with something, it's not like this is probably asking too much of you, but there is a billboard that just went up in Huntington that is trying to reinforce the not reinforce trying to espouse the dangers of vaccines.
trying to discourage people from really from trusting their medical professionals' advice on vaccines and instead directing them to their website for advice about their own health.
It's basically trying to, it's capitalizing on the death of a child and trying to teach people that vaccines can kill. It's at 825 Halger Boulevard here in Huntington, West Virginia. And the company that owns the billboard itself is called West Virginia Outdoor Advertising. Their phone number is 304-342-0932. Since herd immunity affects all of us, I feel like this is an issue that everybody can get fired up about. And just, you know, kind of politely explain to this company that yeah, even though they legally may have the right to put this billboard up, they're hurting their community. And it is dangerous and reckless to take money from groups like this. And maybe tell them how great vaccines are and how they're risking the lives of kids.
Yeah.
That may be a fun thing. We have tried.
I have tried. I've called several times. I've spoken and been promised calls back in response to my concerns and have never received any calls back. Never gotten any answers to my emails. Nothing. They're silent on it. And while, again, there may not be a legal reason they have to take it down, if it were me, I would not want to be complicit in bringing harm to my community by discouraging families from getting vaccines.
So again, that number, 304-342-0932. If you hate the phone, wleslie@wvoutdoor.com is Wade Leslie. That's the president of the company. Just maybe let him know how you feel. Again, we're infringing on your generosity, but we thought we'd ask for your help to help fight the good fight here. That is going to do it for us, folks. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for being here with us. Anything else, Sid?
Just one thing I wanted to mention. If last week's episode, if you downloaded the original file that was in stereo, that was an accident. A lot of people were like, if you're going to do this with your show, we're very upset.
Yeah.
And I understand. We're not going to do that with the show. It was an accident. If you re-download it, it is no longer in stereo. So it will sound the way all of our episodes sound, and we will continue to make them sound. And we are sorry for that inconvenience. It was a complete accident. Not meant to be creepy. As I understand it, it was. That's what people said. It was very creepy. We did not mean for it to be creepy, and I'm sorry.
Folks, that's going to do it for us this week. Thank you so much. Until next time, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.